Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Leon Botstein, who is the president of Bard College, music director and conductor of the American Symphony Orchestra and the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra, and the 2011 Tanner Lecturer at UC Berkeley. Dr. Botstein, welcome to Berkeley.
Well, I'm pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Zurich, Switzerland. My parents were both members of the medical school faculty, my mother in pediatrics, my father in oncology. And then when I was two, the family moved to the United States and we were brought up in New York City.
And looking back, did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
Well, my parents were very unusual people. They were idealists. My mother was she has just died at age 98, and she was an extremely powerful. She wrote the major book on the diagnosis and treatment of polio in the 40s. She was a real pioneer, and my father was a very innovative and important man in the treatment and of cancer that was not surgical. And so in the early days of both radiation therapy and chemotherapy. And they loved what they did, and they also really believed in doing something to help other people. So we grew up in a household. There was an intense engagement with work life. They lived to work. Retirement was a catastrophe for them, and so I think all the three of us developed an enormous work ethic. And also we were immigrants, which meant that we got the message that we didn't know anybody, they didn't know English, they had no connections, that you were essentially what you could do by merit. There was a sort of very harsh lesson about discipline and hard work. And I'm always amazed, there's this book apparently about Chinese American woman, some kind of book.
Amy Chua. Yes,
yeah, about some book about raising. And I didn't read the book, but when you read sort of the news reports, it's very familiar. It's quite a classic immigrant sensibility that achievement was necessary simply for survival.
Now, it's interesting you didn't go into the medical sciences, but you clearly developed a very a sharp perception of the importance of the liberal arts, of music, but also of citizenship and the contribution that a liberal arts education can make.
Sure. My parents were wonderful physicians and clinicians, so which means they understood people and they understood, illness is not separate from, you don't only treat the disease, you treat the patient. And so we understood that very well. I developed a great affection for medicine. It's a wonderful career. My sister is a physician, and my brother is in biological science. He's a very distinguished scientist. So we didn't develop a negative reaction to the career. It wasn't what I wanted to do. My parents, of course, would have loved for all of us to become doctors, but largely because they loved it. They loved medicine. They breathed medicine. They talked medicine. They were in the hospital the whole time. The residence, the whole apparatus of dealing with the forefront of medicine meant a lot to them. And but one of the things we learned is that if you are going to help people through a medical system, they were, for example, firm believers in a socialized medical system, in national health care. They found the American circumstance barbaric. They didn't believe that you should make money from treating the sick. They were very idealistic. And so in a sense, the liberal arts part, the sort of the general education, was simply a necessary component of intervening in people's lives medically. Who is sick, whether they're young or they're old.
Because your parents were immigrants, the world situation, I guess you became, when you were young, very conscious of world events. because as I read about your work as the steward of Bard College, you're very sensitive to relating the education of students to what's going on in the world.
Absolutely. Look, it was the major event in our household was the Second World War, and we were born after the war. But my parents, my father was the only survivor of his family. My uncle, after whom I'm named, was killed in the Warsaw Ghetto. My grandparents of one side did survive, and they survived both ghetto and camp. So for us, the war experience was the central event. When we came to the United States, there was an emigre community in New York of people who had, you know, from the old country. So we grew up with a kind of mythical world that had been eliminated in the destruction of European Jewry. And so for us, world events were not theoretical. My parents very much appreciated. They were immense patriots, but their patriotism to America was about Constitution, about being a citizen, and about the ability to vote. I remember our naturalization ceremony. I was 10. And, you know, the whole question of it was a moral obligation to exercise your obligations as a citizen. And I remember my parents being very sort of critical and talking politics. They never talked down to us. They were discussed political circumstances at the dinner table. And so all of us became early on engaged in the discussion of politics, both history and contemporary politics.
Where were you educated?
We went to public school in the city of New York. I went to the High School of Music and Art. My siblings went to Bronx Science. And then I went to the University of Chicago. My father had a resident, a chief resident, who was a fabulous guy. He was a pianist and a real music lover. And he liked me, and his uncle was Benny Goodman. I later actually had the pleasure of doing a concert with. One of my first public performances was doing the Mozart Clarinet Concerto with Benny Goodman. But he persuaded my father that the University of Chicago would be a good place for me, and so I went there. And I was 16, and had a fabulous experience there. Fabulous experience.
And then your graduate work?
I went to Harvard, to graduate school, and wonderful experience, too. It was more cut up because then I had to leave and worked for the city of New York and then began to work. And then I finished my dissertation later. But I started out directly from college to graduate school.
And your work, both as an undergraduate and a graduate student, was as a musician and a historian you've gone down so many paths that I'm curious as to.
No, I always had two paths. I mean, from early on, when I was 8 or 9, you know, I had this idea of I wanted to become a conductor. I was a violinist, but I didn't have the dexterity, that's a virtuosity dexterity. So for me to play well required 10 times as much time. When I was in Tanglewood, for example, you know, I had a stand-mate who could sight read. I had to, you know, work for hours to play on the level. And my teacher, Roman Totenberg, you know, very early encouraged me to go either into composition or to conducting. And, you know, all of us tried composing. I did myself. And I'm not sure that I was persuaded. When I was undergraduate, I played, for example, for a dance class, you know, improvised on the piano for dance classes. And that was fun. But as a composer, I didn't really have the calling. But I was very interested in performance and the history of music. So I early on had this idea of combining scholarship in the history of music with performance. It was already happening in the early music movement. So people who were interested in Renaissance and Baroque music, it seemed natural to me. I played in the Collegium, which was a early music group in Chicago. Howard Brown, great Renaissance music historian, conducted it. And so I saw a lot of people who are scholars and performers. So I thought, well, we can do that for the 19th and 20th century as well. And Colin Slim, who actually lives in the Bay Area and wonderful musicologist, he was the conductor of the University Orchestra, and I became his assistant. And he was the person who said to me, which was sort of prescient, that, you know, there was the future of music history would be in the 19th and 20th centuries. In those days, people focused a lot on the Baroque, the Renaissance, and medieval period. And that's what interested me, 19th and early 20th century. And so I knew music. So he was very encouraging. And so I sort of made a decision early in college, but I didn't want to do it through musicology. There's something about that that didn't appeal to me. So I did it through European history. Mm-hmm. So my dissertation was actually in the history department, although it's in the history of music.
It seems like you were learning an important lesson about how to make choices about what you could do and what you wanted to do, and reconciling those two things.
Well, I also, I you know, somehow my parents instilled, my father, I think, instilled in me the idea that don't make a career imitatively. Don't look at the earlier generation, the previous generation, and say, I'm going to do exactly what they do. I looked at the previous generation, I said, well, I don't really like what they do. If there's something wrong with it, or why follow in their path? So I was somehow developed an idea that I could figure out how to do this against things that interested me. So, for example, what I thought was lacking in interpretation of music was a reason, an argument. And the source of that argument wasn't only internal to the piece, but somehow about understanding something about the context in which the piece was generated. So I was very struck early on as, you know, what was in Brahms's library? What did he read? What did Beethoven read? What made them composers? You know, recently the diaries of Prokofiev have been released that were, you know, under lock and key for the first 50 years after his death. You read those diaries, it's fascinating, a fantastic writer, and you get a sense of music is not separate. Music isn't out there, whereas we know that literature is part of the fabric of politics and life in general. Painting is as well, architecture is. Well, music is too. And so I had an intuition that that was possible. I remember as an undergraduate reading a book by Panofsky on Gothic architecture and scholasticism, and thinking, well, could the same be done with music? In other words, is it possible people talk intelligently about literature and painting and architecture in relationship to history, broadly conceived? Is it possible to do that with music as well? So that became an ambition of mine, and I combined the two, if you will.
And as a conductor and music director at the American Symphony, you have really innovated in the area that you just talked about.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very simple idea. I mean, all reasonable ideas are usually simple. One was, why have a concert that's simply a mishmash, you know, an Italian overture, from this 18th century and a 19th century, I don't know, French or say a Chopin concerto of the 19th century, and then a 20th century work. It's just put together. There's no reason for it to hang together. So I thought, why not curate a concert the way museum shows are curated? You know, landscape painting of the 19th century, or 20th century experimentalism, or the Bauhaus, or German Romantic painting, or Expressionism. Anything you want. But there's some coherence to it. It's either biographical, it's historical, it's thematic. So why not do the same thing in music? Why not go to a concert that has not a didactic argument, but has a contextual argument? So I just did a concert, for example, on the influence of the Spanish Civil War on Spanish composers. Mm. I took three cases. You know, Joaquin Turina, who was a collaborator with Franco, Roberto Gerhard Acatlan, great composer, who emigrated to London, and then Defaya, who fled to Argentina. You know, and so there are three different responses. I once did a concert about, you know, what it meant to be a composer under Stalin. Was there really something that we can speak of as inner emigration among non-Jewish Germans who were caught in Germany during the Nazi era? So it featured a composer whom I greatly admire, Carl Amadeus Hartmann, who really did real inner immigration, wrote fabulous music, and after the war was a major figure. So one was thematic. I've done concerts that, for example, take the subject of Byron and music, or Dante and music, or issues of painting or literature. Then the other thing was to look at the repertoire, because my feeling, my intuition was, I didn't know this, but as a young person, that why are we playing the same Beethoven 9 symphonies? Why are we doing the 4 Brahms symphonies? There must be somebody else out there. You know, I never identified, you know, people who identify with, you know, the people who are exceptional, you know, Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, and so that So that's right. But there must be people who are really fine, perhaps even great composers, whose names aren't quite so familiar. And why have they disappeared? In a museum, we see their paintings. You go to a museum, the Louvre, the Metropolitan. If they did what we do in music, three-quarters of the rooms in the Metropolitan Museum would be closed. So we have eliminated from the repertory, for some reason, everything but sort of the few masterpieces. We're sort of part of a Olympic contest masterpiece syndrome, the top 10, as if this were some kind of a beauty contest. And so I became interested in reading the history of music about great pieces. Take the opera repertory. I read about an opera by Paul Dukas, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, with a text of Maeterlinck, Ariane Barbleu. Everybody thought it was a great opera. Korngold, Schoenberg, Messiaen. If they thought it was terrific, how come I've never seen it or heard it? I got a vocal score of it. So I began collecting in my mind, a whole repository of music that was first class, but somehow didn't make it into the standard repertory. Mm-hmm. And so that's the other thing that I do.
And so it sounds like your work as a historian has really contributed to your journey down the path of being a conductor. Now, what I'm curious about is going back to the Spanish example you gave. Does that understanding of the context, in what way does it contribute to the appreciation of the differences in the music, or are there differences?
Well, sometimes it's a good question. There's no general rule. Sometimes there's nothing to it, the connection. It just is occasional. That's this person has written music. Now, sometimes there are connections. So Gerhardt, for example, does an ironic twist on markers of Spanishness. The Spanish trumpet call, the evocation of Spanish folk material that we would recognize as Spanish. I went to the concert of all Mexican music. So there's Ponce, Revueltas, and Chavez. Now, Chavez is the least Mexican in some way. Revueltas, the most original in the transformation of what he would consider to be authentic Mexican materials. And Ponce, much more romantic, but still with a reference to it. So it's interesting how the context influences, but doesn't always. The more important thing is discovering that these are wonderful works that make a terrific argument, that move audiences. It's good music, whatever that means, but it's not second rate. That for some reason, we don't do this in film and we don't do this in literature. We don't read a book and say, well, that's not War and Peace. We don't look at a film and we go criticize the film, but we don't make an immediate comparison to Casablanca. And we don't go every year to see Casablanca 17 times. So why we do this? Why we do this in music? It's not that we don't like Casablanca, but I've had enough of it. The Mahler symphonies deserve to be put on the shelf, and let's bring something else, either contemporary or from the past. People got tired of reading Dickens. Well, they Trollope came into being. We've done this in literature. We've brought back things that have vanished, certainly in painting. People like Courbet, and there are a whole bunch of artists. Böcklin, one of the great artists of the 19th century, forgotten, totally revived. The whole Viennese modernism. There was a time when Klimt and Schiele were minor figures. They're now major figures. So why do we do this in music? And that's the task that I'm committed to. But the real criterion at the end is whether, and I've not always succeeded. Sometimes music is not as persuasive as I think it is. I'm more fascinated than sometimes the audience. But you always know in the players, the orchestras, we've had very good track record in recovering the past. I want to end the falsification of the musical past.
A theme that you pursue in your lectures, and I don't want to go into this in detail, but you also have an interest in the way changes in technology affect the music that is produced and the music literacy of the audience.
Absolutely.
Talk a little about that.
Well, the basic issue in the modern time is that the piano, modern piano, and the way it was constructed and the way it sounds, drove our sense of sonority. So, for example, the way we play violin today is influenced by the modern piano. The pitch, the way sound is produced, the sonority, and the modern orchestra, in fact, the modern piano, develop very, very much in tandem. The kind of rich sound that you'll see in a big, lush Strauss or Mahler sonority of the modern orchestra. The second thing, of course, is that the most important thing is in the 20th century, when the long playing record comes into being, the audience today has a kind of attitude to going to concerts that's unimaginable in the past, because people will come and have heard a Mahler symphony or a Beethoven symphony hundreds of times, and the same performance. They in their car, when they had a cassette, now they have a CD, now they have an iPod, they've listened, either it's Carrion or Bernstein or Toscanini, over and over. Suddenly, the text has disappeared. When you're a performer and you get up to do a standard work, you're working against a crowd that hasn't ever read Hamlet, but they have seen Jack Nicholson do Hamlet. And in their ear is only Jack Nicholson. And if you're not Jack Nicholson, they don't think it's right. You know, now this is an impossible situation, because suddenly reading Shakespeare becomes one way of doing it. You know, it's John Gielgud. And, you know, if it happened to be, Tommy Lee Jones, you know, you're in trouble, because people have identified with a certain tradition in their ear that's been imprinted, the tempo, the way it's read. So it's very hard to reassert the independence of interpretation with an audience that whose habits of expectation are derived from repeated listenings of one or two recorded performances. So that's the most terrifying aspect. Now, it's getting better, because with the internet, there's so much on the internet that people are getting used to not sticking to one. So they'll surf around and get different, and they suddenly wake up and realize there's not one way of doing it, which is, for us, a great boon.
Let's talk about the other hat that you've worn, which is that of university president. Let's go back to your early part of your career and tell us how you became the youngest president of a college.
By accident, I needed a job. And this was a bankrupt institution in bankruptcy in northern New Hampshire that was protected by Dartmouth. And John Kemeny and the then chaplain of Dartmouth, Paul Raymeyer, some reason took a risk on me because nobody wanted the job.
This was what college?
Franconia College. It was bankrupt. It was founded in 64, closed in 79. It went into Chapter 11 in 68. So it was really its most famous alumnus is Jamaica Kincaid, the writer. And it was a wacky idea, but they were very generous, and the board of that bankrupt institution was run by bankers and Dartmouth faculty. And so the father of a girlfriend of mine, her brother was there. It was a place where kids who couldn't get in elsewhere, it was the draft during the Vietnam era, people were staying out of the draft. It was a fabulous place. I'm not criticizing it, but it was really an experimental college. It was really a progressive experimental college. And so they talked me into taking the job. I did it for 5 years. We took it out of bankruptcy. We got it accredited. And then I got recruited to Bard. So I got into it by accident.
Yeah. And you have been president of Bard for how many years?
Since 75. So that's 35 years.
Yeah. Okay. So the question that first comes to my mind, what is the comparability of leading a symphony orchestra and leading a college or institution of higher education? Are there similar qualities of leadership that are required, or is it two different realms?
No, it's very much the same. People always think it's different. It's very much integrated. Now, of course, different kind of work. In an orchestra, conducting is essentially a visual pantomime that shapes sound, and you have to persuade colleagues, very sophisticated colleagues, to follow you. And you have to persuade them that what you're doing is plausible and right. Very similar to a faculty or a student body. You have to actually persuade them that to go along. Also, you have to respond positively to what they come up with. In rehearsal, if a wind player or a soloist phrases a certain way, instead of imposing what you have in mind, you have to listen to them. Now, if you disagree, so there are some related aspects, and part of it is developing a relationship with people in a group setting. So one of the things you have to do is no conductor should attempt to think that he or she has a kind of complete infallibility of knowledge. So in rehearsal, for example, I'm able to acknowledge if something goes wrong that it's my fault, not the player's fault. I learn a more comfortable relationship between having authority and not being dictatorial. And the same thing in leading a university. You can't, or a college, you can't actually. You have to treat your colleagues with genuine respect, whether they be students or faculty. So there are real overlaps in dealing with people.
Mm-hmm. Now, so what is the biggest challenge of running a college committed to liberal arts, committed to a general education that informs students about what it is to do science, what it is to be concerned about public affairs, what it is to be aware of globalization, and what it is to appreciate art and music and so on?
Well, Bard is a particular history. So it's 2 hours north of New York. It's a private institution. So the first task is, I believe, it's my view, is that a private institution has to be in the public interest. And that's number one. Number two, you have to create a context in which the intellectual tradition that you describe is actually relevant to the content of daily life and to democracy. Very important, basic idea. The third is that teaching is crucial. The quality of undergraduate teaching has been devalued in research universities particularly. And that undergraduate teaching is absolutely important, and it's not separate from research. So you also have an ambition to have a high quality operation. So Bard, what we've done is to try to create a context for undergraduate learning. So we have two public high schools in the city of New York, which Bard runs. We're opening a third in Newark, which are combinations of high school and college. They're public schools, not private schools. We have the largest prison education program in the country. We have three overseas campuses, one in Kyrgyzstan with the American University in Central Asia. We have a joint venture with the University of St. Petersburg, Smolny, the first liberal arts college in post-Soviet Russia. And we have a teacher training graduate program and a college with Al-Quds University on the West Bank. And have a huge graduate for us infrastructure in the arts. So we have a curatorial studies graduate program. We have a PhD and MA in decorative arts and material culture. We try to do different things in the arts. We have an MFA in the arts. So we've tried to expand what we do. We have a big summer festival, which is, I think, very innovative. So we publish a literary magazine, Conjunctions. We have a contemporary art museum. So we try to do things that enter the public arena that other places don't and won't. The very wealthy institutions, because they're very conservative and hidebound. The public institutions, because they're overwhelmed with their own agenda. So we create a real context for undergraduate study that's a very high quality. We also are not organized in an imitative way of graduate departments. So there's no department of anthropology, no department of this. So we don't have a kind of mirror image of the graduate professionalization of the university. So the faculty is organized in four big divisions, which creates a much more fluid ground for creating a curriculum that's based on a need to know and not on the bureaucratic segmentation of particular disciplines, legitimate as that may be.
It's very clear in your background and in our discussion of music that you're very sensitive to the issue of getting people to think and to think differently about topics. How does one master that with regard to with today's student? Mm-hmm. You know, do you have to go against the grain in terms of general education in the United States, or what is the key there?
Well, the key there, first of all, is to realize that our secondary education system is very broken. My view is the secondary system is the worst part of the American public system. So we've been very active in trying to reform and improve the secondary system. The second is when the student comes to Bard, we have a 3-week intensive immersion in thinking and writing, which is the teaching of the use of writing as the development, the technique by which you discover what you think and why you think it. And the third thing is try to organize the curriculum not by the organizative subject matter, but try to respond to the need to know. So, for example, the need to know now is different than it was, let's say, in the 50s. In the 50s, the issue of the Cold War, the post-war era, so the Soviet communism versus democracy, there's a whole set of problems. Today, for example, many of the traditional issues of politics or political theory are motivated by the framing of issues of human rights. It's a different generational framing. How do people enter the long tradition of conversation? Technology, for example, is huge in the way we make art. So the tradition of art making isn't from drawing from a model, but it may be using the computer. It may be visualization through computer technology. So there are different questions are asked by different generations. So the issue is, if you listen to the question, then you have to respond by saying, well, what do you need to know to solve those issues? So we have a program of general education, and we read Plato, and we read Rousseau and Locke, and you know, it's a great books, but the great books are organized in relationship to trying to help undergraduates develop the tools to respond to the issues that they're concerned about.
Now, you've innovated with a program in kind of science education. Talk a little about that, because that's a good example of what you just explained.
Okay, so our view is that the citizen today cannot be as scientifically illiterate as he or she is. We graduate people in all but the sciences who are really in the dark ages. So their ignorance about science is a liability. It goes in both directions. It goes in the very far right direction of people thinking, well, evolution, well, there's no evidence for evolution. It's just an idea. Who knows? Well, that happens not to be true, right? Then there's another side, which is people who want to have organic food. Well, the whole word organic food is, it's a manipulation, a marketing of something. There's something to it, but what would it mean to have, what does it mean to have genetically engineered food? So there's a lot on the extreme right and the extreme left, which is filled with ignorance. Take one of the tragic examples, which we'll never erase, the idea that that the people who fraudulently argue that there's a relation between autism and vaccine, a certain vaccine, it turned out to be totally fraudulent. So you want to arm the citizen to be able to follow many of the issues of public policy that have to do with the environment, with health, disease, energy, that have a scientific base, so a knowledge base, but also a thinking base about statistics, about probability, about evidence, what is evidence. So we decided to do a 3-week intensive between the first and second semester for all students, ungraded, for all first-year students, where we look at infectious disease, called citizen science, in which they study what is an infectious disease, how do scientists study this, how is it, you know, how do you deal with it, what makes it infectious, and then what are the modes of treatment and response in the public health issues and the social issues, both to yourself and to your neighbor. Do you get a flu shot or do you not get a flu shot? Swine flu, for example. So there are some, and what are the, how would you evaluate the risk or the probabilities, you know, is it more dangerous to take the vaccine or, you know, what? How do you evaluate those? So you begin to get the tools by which a person can follow and form an opinion as opposed to simply being dependent on experts where their allegiances are ideological. You know, they come from my church or they come from the people I trust without being independent. A real democracy requires citizens to be able to form their own judgments on the basis of some reasonable evidence or understanding. The same thing is we need to, in our curriculum, need to people understand things about parts of the world that didn't seem that important in 1950, but are now important, whether it's Asia or Latin America or Africa. Mm-hmm. Not for political correctness.
Right. As I listen to you and I've read some of what you've written, I would think that you have a real handle on creativity. Creativity in music, creativity as a leader of an institution of higher education, but also the problem of do you teach creativity or do you create a context for people to learn to be creative?
You create a context. Look, one of the most important things we've done is two programs. One, we have a program of reforming and improving the schools in post-Katrina New Orleans. And the other is we have this large prison program. Both are the work of students who came to see me. So the context, what we're proud of, is that a student could come see me and say, I have an idea. We should be doing something with the prisons that are in our region in New York, and these men and women who are incarcerated have no opportunity for a real education. The American romance with prison is a catastrophe. This is an undergraduate speaking. And so he put the challenge to me. He said, instead of the sort of volunteering, you know, it's just really sort of condescending, why don't we put a real degree program, and would Bard give degrees to prisoners if they finished a BA degree the way we finish a BA degree, with a senior thesis and all this kind of thing? And I think he expected me to say, oh, well. So I looked at him and I said, you know, I thought, you know, he doesn't have a... I give him the low odds to get it done. So I figured I'm pretty safe. You know, I say, well, Max Kenner, I said, we'll do it. We'll give a degree. So he was shocked. He said, you don't mean that. I said, no, I give you my word. You come up with the program and the funding. I thought he doesn't have a chance, you know. He put it together. It's now 10 years old. Fantastic program. It wasn't my idea. It was his idea. When Stephen Tremaine, a student from Louisiana, after Katrina hit, said, we need to do something. I want to put a volunteer program. I want to help with the schools and blah, blah, blah. Will you back us? And I said, well, what do you want to do? And he described it. I thought it was very intense, fabulous young guy. And I said, yeah, well, we'll back you. Now he works for us. We have a big volunteer program in the Broadmoor District and working to improve secondary education in New Orleans. It wasn't my idea. It was his idea. So my role is to create the context by which people feel, you know, you can get something done. You know, one of the things you have to risk when you run an institution is you have to risk being stupid. You have to risk that someone will sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, you're like a patent office. You're creating an opportunity for people to register their ideas and realize them. And some of them are bad patents. They don't work, you know. It's a form of refrigeration that doesn't function. Sometimes you lose. And you can't feel embarrassed because you're really betting on the idea that does work. And we've had enough of them that have worked. And your role is to help refine the idea. You don't have to have the idea, but you have to be a good critic of the idea in a way. If you want to make it work, you have to be empathetically able to say, well, they want to do this, maybe this is a different way of doing it, and it'll work better. So you help in the design and realization of the idea.
You're very sensitive to the role that technology plays in changing literacy. You talk about it in your lectures on musical literacy. Obviously, the internet is revolutionizing education. How do we, or you as a leader of an institution, master the phenomena of the technology so that students won't lose the capacity to think? And at the same time,
this is a huge problem. I don't think we have a solution. We're actually involved now with a technology company thinking about how to do what's called distance learning well. You know, you have this phenomenon of the University of Phoenix and sort of really diploma mills, you know, that are doing very well with online education. Now, there's clearly something to the communication skill and the data storage retrieval possibilities of modern computation. But how does it intersect with real teaching and learning is something we haven't quite figured out. So we're looking at how to make that work, what's called distance learning or technology-based learning. The other problem is one you raise, which is, you know, the internet is a kind of sewage system. Huge sewer. And there are a lot of things that are in that sewer that are worthwhile. There's a lot of junk, too. So how do you distinguish? I mean, I'm always amazed. I mean, you know, I'm always amused to look up a Wikipedia article on St. Augustine. Now, insofar as it's comprehensible, you know, if you know something about the subject, it becomes dicey, you know, and there's a lot of junk in it and so forth. Now, it doesn't make it a bad thing, but when you Google a subject or an issue, it's a huge problem how to distinguish in a situation where there's no editorial, you know, you can't even figure out the bias of the New York Times. You read the New York Times, you already know, you're pretty armed at reading between the lines, you have an idea, you know, about what questions to ask about what are the inherent bias. You pick up the National Review or the Washington Times, which is a more conservative paper, and these kinds of things. But in the internet, you're sort of helpless. And teaching young people who are in college the ability to distinguish fact from fiction or things that are on the internet that are completely either defamatory or just plain false, It's hard. I mean, it's very hard. The overwhelming volume, the scale of information is daunting. You know, I never really realized until very recently how much material there is, for example, musical material is on YouTube. It's a riot. You know, we have a conductor's institute in the summer where we teach conducting and with a live orchestra. And it was through that that I realized that these are people in mid-career or early in career who are spending six intensive weeks under a master teacher, Harold Farberman, my own teacher, trying to learn and perfect skills of conducting. And there's so much, which we never had, video information on conductors of the past on YouTube. And you can see, I don't know, Carlos Kleiber, Hermann Scherchen, or who knows. I mean, there's some audio stuff, but there's also video stuff. And I find myself, you know, a student will tell me, well, I looked on video and I said, really? So I would go home, go to YouTube, look at it. I'm sort of amazed, you know, to look at it. And so there are tremendous advantages, you know. It's very interesting to watch these documents. So the wealth of material is, and the wealth of recorded material. For example, we have, American Symphony has 160, 180, 200 downloadable MP3 files of live performances we've done. So you can, if you want to hear Hausegger's Wieland der Schmied, there's a recording of it, the only one, you know. So we have a lot of this material out there. And that's terribly helpful. So you can retrieve a lot of sound documentation and a variety of it that's far better than the old Schwann catalog, you know, where there were five recordings of one piece or even one recording of one piece. And now they're just endless supply. So there is a certain amount of advantage to it. But how to negotiate and how to teach negotiating it is not different from the close critical reading that is traditionally taught. Whether it's a book or a Kindle or on your iPad or on the screen, asking sharp questions about what's being said or claimed is still somewhat the same enterprise.
What does an ideal curriculum look like, do you think? I mean, language is important, obviously. Learning to write and think is important.
Language is at the center. The active use of language, you know. Every scientist, you know, keeps a lab book, a lab notebook, keeps a record, has to articulate in language what it is she or he works on. So that's clearly, and understanding the origins of language and how to read very carefully. I do, for example, in the Great Book Seminar that we have that every student takes, with sections of it. You know, I have students read aloud and then interpret what they've read. It's a very simple, old-fashioned way of stopping to think carefully about what do you mean when you say something and what does what you say mean? You know, I think Stanley Cavell, the philosopher, had a wonderful book called "Do We Mean Something Like?" Had titles sort of like that, as I recall. And so there is a that's crucial to a curriculum. And so you teach the undergraduate how to frame questions, how to distinguish a good question from a bad one, and how to go about sort of figuring out what a plausible answer would be, and ways of argument and thinking and rules of evidence and rules of research or discovering or finding out material or evaluating data. An ideal curriculum is also contextual, and it's not fixed. Where I differ from people who support things like the St. John's curriculum or the old sort of great books idea is that there isn't really a canonic issue. A book is important because it works. The Republic is a great book to teach, not because it's canonic. It has a historical importance, no question about that, and that's good, but also because it is so fabulous in its capacity to teach an undergraduate the art of interpretation, finding plausible ways of reading things. The Bible has the same capacity. The reason we defend the choice of certain texts over others is not a normative, prescriptive one, because it argues something we believe, but because it's an excellent teaching tool. Gulliver's Travels is a great teaching tool. Some people don't like it because it sort of seems familiar as a kind of children's book, but it is no children's book, and it's a fantastic teaching tool. Montaigne is a fantastic teaching tool. There are some don't work quite so well, and it's not because they're lesser, but because they don't actually. You want to choose the text for their capacity to teach argument and analysis.
What was the major obstacle that you encountered as you brought kind of these innovative ways of thinking to running a college?
What I do has the great advantage of being completely unimportant. You know, I'm not the president of the University of California, Berkeley. I'm not the president of Johns Hopkins. I never had those ambitions, or of Harvard or Princeton or Yale. So nobody gives a damn. It's great to be under the radar screen. You know, there was this story, you know, there was that guy who flew to Moscow in the Cold War, but was below, you know, this guy from Berlin, landed in Red Square. It made an impression upon me, you know, this is a good idea. In other words, we're influential because we are, no one pays attention. You know, when Mayor Giuliani and Harold Levy asked us to do a public school, radical idea, in the city of New York that combined high school and college, so when you got out of the 12th grade, you finished a junior college degree, you entered in the 9th grade, a public school in the city of New York. And the union had just then blocked the privatization or the private contracting of a school to the Edison. The UFT, wonderful, you know, teachers union, whom I have a lot of regard for. I'm not one of the people who are in the union bashing business. The UFT got hammered, you know, for preventing this other innovation. They looked at us, and that's one of the reasons they said, we're happy, because they thought we're nuts. We're never going to make it. These people are crazy. You know, they're coming in here. They have nothing. They're not getting paid. They're white knights. They're fools. You know, they're never going to make this. Never going to stick. So why not go ahead? So we have a memorandum of agreement with the city of New York. We control the curriculum. We actually have made something work. The UFT has participated and collaborated. They get part of the credit. We get part of the credit. We show it's not a charter school. It's a real public school. So our advantage has been our unimportance. Nobody notice us. By the time they notice us, it's too late. What I learned is that people want to make careers always flying the main line. So it's like the airlines, you know, we're the JetBlue. You know, the ambition wasn't, you know, to follow in the wake of American Airlines. It was to do something different. And the obstacle is people's disbelief. You know, people don't return my phone calls. I don't have a Rolodex. I'm completely unimportant. I'm meaningless. And that's a little depressing because you've worked real hard and you'd like to have more impact. But, you know, you're not, you don't, you know, no one's going to pay attention to you. And that is a certain freedom, because then you actually can get something done. And if you stick to something without, and that's where you get people to collaborate. I've been only as good as the people I've been able to recruit, faculty and colleagues. And when they really believe that you're willing to risk everything to do it right, people will follow along, that you're not going to, and you're also willing to accept failure. You know, if something doesn't work, you're willing to look at it right in the face and not blame somebody else and take the blame yourself.
You're positioned to understand the failings of our educational system. In your book, Jefferson's Children, you take on a lot of the problems, the ideological component of different views, the sense of over-idealizing the past, right, and being too pessimistic about the future, the fact that politicians use education as a whipping boy. Is there a way to sort of summarize your critique and point to what your career tells us about where we need to move?
Well, let me say that the book, which was written under duress about 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, was a total failure until the shooting in Columbine. And Oprah Winfrey picked the book up. So I owe whatever influence it has and the ability to do these early colleges in the public sector owing to her advocacy. Because I write in there about the abolition of the American high school. But the answer to your question is the single most important thing is that education kills children's curiosity and is a necessary evil. Homeschooling is the oldest and most proven way of schooling. But it's not plausible, right, as a social system. So the question is, if you're going to have schools, the most important thing is put young children particularly, but adolescents also, with people who love the subject matter and understand it. If we have math anxiety, it's because the elementary school teacher doesn't understand math, doesn't know what a number is. And the kids are totally panicked because the teacher is panicked. Parents have the same problem. So you have a child, and the child says to you, Mom or Dad, why does the sun go down? Now, if you really want, that's what the kid is interested in. The kid is not interested in George Washington. The kid isn't really interested in ideological debates about anything, culture wars of anything, ethnic identity or anything. They're interested in the natural world. That's their primary. Why does it rain? Why does the sun shine? Why is it hot? Why is it cold? So, the sun going down. Well, the truth is that a parent has to be able to say, without frightening the child, that, well, the sun really isn't going down. You know, we're moving. So the question is, the kid's going to say, well, how do you know? Same as the kid's going to say, well, you say, well, you tell the child, well, the earth isn't flat. Because it looks pretty flat to me. And in fact, it actually feels flat. So how do you, without frightening, because a lot of the truth is counterintuitive. It's not commonsensical. So teachers have to be able to not to rely on authority, mere authority, which kills curiosity, but engender that curiosity because they really understand the subject. So if a kid doesn't understand music, doesn't understand rhythm, if you understand really how music works and you can find a way to listen to the kid, because what a child doesn't know, ignorance is not uniform. Knowledge is an approximation. That's what's wrong with standardized testing. Standardized testing is a crime. It's a crime because it assumes that knowledge is a zero-sum game. A young person who can, every person doesn't quite understand or does think he or she understands something for different reasons. So how do you diagnose that approximation, and how do you adjust for it? That's one of the things technology can do. It can, to some extent, adapt. The whole testing system is antiquated. Imagine if we had a test in which the person, when he or she got the wrong answer, the clock stopped as in a chess game and engaged a program where the young person discovered right away. I mean, we don't, on a baseball field, the kid you know, runs to third base instead of the first base, somebody tells him right away that he's made a mistake. He'll never do it again. But if they tell him 6 months later, they send him a letter in the mail and said, you did eight things wrong, you know, in the nine innings, they're going to say, well, I don't know which ones I did wrong. Imagine kids take tests and never know what they got right or wrong. Well, it kills curiosity. Kills any. It's a ludicrous system. So the educational system is catastrophic and needs to be fundamentally reformed. And has to be reformed by recruiting and training teachers who really understand what they're teaching to the age group. So the most important math training is for the elementary school teacher, not for the university training. And therefore, we have to organize the training of teachers not through schools of education, but through the fields vertically. So the people who should be talking and figuring out what should be in the elementary school are mathematicians and physicists about what should be taught in physics. And that's the way it should go. And that's what's wrong with the American system, because it's more organized horizontally by the age you're teaching. And in schools of education, in the pseudoscience of education, which I think is an absolute catastrophe. So there's one principle, is the love of learning. And the love of learning, because the questions and the subject matter really motivate you. You know, how does life work? You know, how does the world work? You know, how do we understand history? You know, what is literature? People who really love the subject. And that is infectious. Young people, children, will be inspired by it. That's successful music teaching. So we don't have the quality of teachers that the country needs.
On that note, and that rather stark indictment, and thank you very much for joining us today. Let me show your book, Jefferson's Children, because I think it's still worth a read.
If you can find it on the internet.
Well, I got it at Amazon.
So oh, that's good. That's good.
So, Dr. Botstein, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
For being here today. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.